This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
When you post hunting photos on Instagram, they get censored. When you post on Go Wild, you get virtual fist bumps from fellow hunters. When you buy gear on Amazon, you gas up a billionaire spaceship. When you buy gear on Go Wild, we donate to a camp that teaches kids to hunt, fish, and shoot. See the difference? Go Wild is a free social community built by hunters for hunters. Join today at downloadgowild.com, and I'll give you $10 just for setting up your account. And you'll keep unlocking Go Wild rewards as you share content, because guess what? We like hunting pictures. Join at downloadgowild.com or in the App Store.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you. All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy podcast. We have got some exciting podcast stories to talk to you guys about. We've got hunt successes, and that's a big time of the year for us is talking with people who have implemented these projects, who are seeing results, who are, you know, kind of coming full circle because they're killing some big deer in their respective areas and seeing the correlations that we talk about week in and week out. So we're not going to waste a lot of time and getting in to hear this story. But before we do, make sure you take a few moments this week. Vortex has just released a new apparel line for this fall and winter. You're an outdoors person. You like just graphic tees. You like that brand. You like that logo. Go check it out at vortexoptics.com. Click the apparel tab, and then at checkout, you listeners get a 20% off. Use Land and Legacy 20 to get a discount on Vortex apparel. And you're going to love it. We wear it all the time. So check it out, vortexoptics.com. All right. So as we're getting in here, we're going to be talking with Mike Hinkle. Mike lives down in Texas. So he's a non-resident landowner who owns property in North Missouri. We're going to kind of review the property, and then we're going to dive into all the things that he's done and then the success that he has had, not only this year, but last year too, because this is important to note. What we want to find is consistency in activity and consistency in success. So without further ado, Mike, are you there? Can you hear me, Mike?
I can. How are you, Matt?
There we go. All right. Nope, that was on my end right there. So I'm good. I am good. I'm ready and excited to be able to chat about all the success that you've had.
Well, I'm excited to share it with you.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Mike, pre-bringing you on here, talked about the fact that you're a non-resident landowner. You reside in Texas, but your property is in North Missouri. So right out of the gate, there's some challenges to, you know, the distance and being as active on the property in manipulations and such habitat work that you want to do. I'm sure there's always stuff that you wanted to get done, but you didn't have enough time, or you get up there and you're rained out for 3 of the 5 days that you're there. So just kind of bring us up to speed a little bit of the property, some rough details, and then kind of talk about some of those challenges, because I know there's a lot of people out there who are in that same boat. They don't live on site, or it's just, you know, half hour, even 3, 4, 5 hours away. But I want to say the trip's about 8 hours for you, but yet you're still successful in your time management to be able to accomplish a lot of different projects over the course of years, and that includes Prescribed Fire. So I'm just going to kind of turn it over to you to talk about the farm and then kind of address that deal that you know a lot of people are dealing with.
Yeah, so it's not 8 hours, it's 10 hours, and that's if I only stop for fuel.
yeah, 10 so, hours.
Yeah, and if I have the wife or some fam, it's closer to 11 and a half. Mm-hmm. But anyway, mm-hmm. I love the area. I bought some acreage about 12 years ago because I wanted to have a place that had good whitetail hunting.
Yeah.
And with the chance of what I would think considered to be a good size bucks and a decent deer herd. So mm-hmm. I picked Putnam County.
Yep.
And in the last 12 years, I've doubled the size of when, as neighbors have offered, had land come up.
Sure.
And I retired 5 years ago. So that's made it a lot easier to do the habitat work, but at least having time. But certainly the challenge is around timely rains and basically around weather
mm-hmm.
and being able to have some adequate time to complete a project and do it in the weather conditions, or at least the weather conditions that are predicted.
Right.
But when I bought the place, it was primarily cattle grazing and had about 20 acres of row crop on it.
Right.
And then after I bought it, I had a cash rent or farmer, and he started farming about 140 acres
mm-hmm.
and the farm is 400. So, I did that until I retired. And what I got tired of was having all the beans or corn getting taken off.
Yeah.
And the income was good, but half of my farm became a desert.
Bare and naked.
It was naked. And, yeah. and at that time I just started to do some timber work. So, uh-huh. My timber wasn't really great habitat either. So, I started doing some timber stand improvement, and then I realized, after I did a couple years of doing some 5 to 10 acre projects, that multiflora rose came back with a vengeance.
Right.
And
right.
I needed to burn. So I took a burn class. I was like everybody else. Oh, I don't want to burn up my farm or burn up the neighborhood. And taking a class and going on a burn and getting a little experience gave me, you know, the confidence that I needed to burn. And
yep.
As a side note on burning, I don't know how people do it without a drip torch or a backpack blower, because
right.
those two tools
amazing.
Are, yeah, they make it a lot easier and take a lot of the pucker factor
exactly.
out of controlling it
yeah.
and helps your back.
Oh, yeah.
So then I started doing, I applied for some cost share and mm-hmm. had some vendors help. And then I started doing it myself, Matt. And when I bought it as a hunting property.
Yeah.
And I started doing habitat work and doing some food plots. And I found out that I like that as much or more than the hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the gratification is just, you know, it's such a blessing to be able to harvest a deer that you have some history with and that maybe you had a little bit of influence
sure.
on why that deer lives on your property or at least frequents your property.
Yeah.
And
that's a really cool like impact to have and to know and feel. I think, you know, we all want like this, maybe this isn't the best phrase, but like this almost intimate connection or something with, you know, the animal that we're pursuing. If we're targeting specific deer, you want that connection. So every time that you have an encounter, you're like, ah, oh, that connection or whatever grew. But when you, as a land manager, land owner, can be tied so closely to the property and the land and your fingers on the pulse of that property and what deer are doing as a reaction to what you've done to the land to manipulate it, to manage it, to improve it, to restore it, that takes that like almost intimacy to that next level and that degree. Because as you'll find out like later on the podcast, a lot of the success that you guys are having on this property is coming as a result of cutting and burning. And that's exactly what you texted Adam and I. You sent us a message, I think it was maybe first or second week of November, cut, burn, and repeat. And here's a picture of a great archery harvest. I think it was a 10-pointer or so. And man, that's great. That's wonderful. But here, that's the reason why, you know, you're seeing this success. And then, you know, less than 2 weeks later, here comes another one, cut, burn, and repeat again. Gun season opened up and you were successful on, I think, one of the biggest deer you've killed on this place. And coming out of an area that you had cut and burned just this year. So there's a lot of, we know now, and listeners know now, that there is something to be said, because we say it all the time, but this marriage between cutting that allows sunlight to get in and then burning to manipulate the landscape to improve the understory, to diversify it, to try and restore, you know, a lot of native plant communities coming back in there. So they know all of that from our end of things. But from the land manager, non-land and legacy consultant, Mike, what is it that you've seen as a result, not only in the deer herd and in the hunting, but just as the farm itself has developed since you've adopted this, okay, manipulate the timber, now I need to burn. You've done this for enough years now that you've seen changes in the farm, the way the wildlife are responding to it. And before you do that, I want to make a note that your property sits in a big cooperative. It sits in a neighborhood that, as a cooperative, many of the landowners are selecting to pass older age class deer. So we want to recognize the importance of that, of a co-op, but at the same time, you within that co-op, and you've been told from, you know, private land conservationists within the state that you're the most intensely worked habitat within this cooperative. So within a good area and a good neighborhood, your habitat, your property, what you're doing, how you're managing the farm is still in the best state and in the best habitat within this good neighborhood. So, you know, of course, someone's going to listen and say, well, yeah, of course he's successful, right? But that's the point. That's the scenario, and what we're trying to say is try and find yourself in a good neighborhood, but at the same time, you still need to shine. You still need to manipulate the habitat. Just because you're in a neighborhood that says I'm passing older age class deer doesn't mean that you're always going to have that still that success. So you've kind of taken a two-step approach to it. But that's, you know, a rough idea of the neighborhood. But talk to me about that cut, burn, repeat stage. What is it you're seeing?
So, you know, the first time that I cut, I didn't cut enough, but to me it looked like a bomb went off. So it was a little bit nervous and scary.
Yeah, yeah. And, which is typical. Saw, that's normal.
Yeah, so what I saw the first time was actually during turkey season that I saw a lot more hen activity.
Okay.
During the turkey season. So they were in that slash and created better nesting cover for the turkeys.
Wait, you're telling me that turkeys were in thick understories with some top, cedar tops, some hickory tops and oak tops laying on the ground. They don't like that clean understory. I say that because I know the property. I know that right next door is cattle farm and timber that cows have access to that's clean as a whistle. So even the wild turkey, the hen, was increasing usage on the property.
Yeah, so that was the first thing that I noticed was we did some TSI in the winter. So the spring when it was first starting to green up, that was my first evidence of what were things that were different. Because at first I thought, did I make a mistake? Because this looks horrible and I can't see very far. And, so I saw that activity and then it gave me more confidence that, well, maybe this is the right thing to do, even though I had a private land conservationist from the state of Missouri, you know, tell me about it. And you still have a little bit of apprehension when you're cutting down old trees, even though they might be shagbark hickories and really don't have any value.
Right.
And they don't provide any value to wildlife when it's a closed canopy. So I saw that as evidence. And then during the following winter, I saw more beds in that type of area. I could see woody stems being browsed.
Yeah.
But then the following year, what I noticed was just the explosion of some undesirable species too. What we have in that part of Missouri is multiflora rose, and there just is very little wildlife benefit. And so then I got it. That's what really motivated me to get into the burning.
Right.
Because I wanted to control that. And you can do it mechanically, but with fire, it's just a lot easier, cheaper. And
totally.
So that kind of got me started in the burn fire rotation, really to manage the undesirable species. But then what happened is that burning then released a lot more desirable forbs out of the seed bank. And I mean, it just created a food plot, basically.
Yeah.
So I noticed the effectiveness of that really in the wintertime when food plots or ag crops are gone or food plots are depleted. And you see, that's where the deer are at. I never really paid attention to looking at woody stems and browse tips and buds before to that level of detail until I started doing that. And I could see what the effect of this cut and burn cycle, how beneficial it was
to
a deer, particularly outside of the hunting season, which coincided with the whitetails and other animals, whether it's turkeys or quail, starting to want to make my farm part of their home range.
And I think that's really important, especially in context with the fact that you're in a cooperative, right? So surrounding area, there's other people who do work. It's not like it's absent of habitat improvements or undesirable type locations, but still for you to be successful year in and year out, harvesting a great deer last year with the bow, a bow buck, a nephew killing a bow buck this year too, and then another firearms harvest this year. That's four bucks who are of age, whatever you're determining, 4.5 and older, that meet that criteria. But you're seeing those deer frequent you enough from a home range, from a core area standpoint, that the property has improved to the degree that you have home bodies. You have deer that are selecting the improved sites at a very high frequency, which allows you, again, to be just that much more successful year in and year out. And something that we talked about pre-show, which was, I thought, interesting, these aren't deer that are just kind of popping up and dropping in, and you're like, oh, gosh, who's this deer? You know these deer from year in and year out. That's what's important.
I'd like to have a surprise buck, but I have in our co-op, which is about 3,000 acres, we generally classify in our neighborhood a mature deer being 4.5 years.
Right.
And most, I mean, that is really awesome and a key to live, to have a place in a great neighborhood. But it wasn't like that when I started. So,
right.
There was a couple of us that got interested in what was QDMA at the time and setting up a co-op. And it really was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. It's a matter of taking some initiative to make some contact,
sure,
and encouraging people. And you find out that they basically want the same thing as you.
Uh-huh.
It ends up being
a ton of common ground.
Right. You got to get over the, if I don't shoot him, he will.
Yeah. Yeah.
Attitude. So, and that was a lot easier than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people, do a lot of habitat. Most do food plots, but I won't necessarily say that's habitat, but they do food plots.
Sure.
And some do habitat. But I think having a overall program of habitat, almost in a year round, there's some different things that you can do that helps manipulate the landscape that will work in your favor, that will influence your target bucks or mature bucks to give you a higher odds of a harvest,
mm-hmm,
or shooting. And that's I have been fortunate in the last I think five of the 6 years have been able to harvest a 4.5 year old or older deer, and I have not shot every one of those deer. I have pictures of.
I love that.
So
yeah.
Now, like I said, I'd love to see a surprise. I've had some surprise pictures on my trail camera, but that has been, you know, they're just coming through.
Sure.
They're not living there. They're probably looking for a doe or getting outside of their core area. But I've got some, at least some picture history and or sheds. And we'll share pictures between co-op members, and that's, mm-hmm, kind of how we determine, okay, is it 4.5, you know, without having a fair amount of pictures or sheds,
right,
you know, just to age on the hoof, you know, it's, you can make a guess, but having that other intel really makes it a lot easier. And then I send in my incisors every year, and so,
okay,
do some,
sure,
other people.
Yeah.
And yep. The state, I was able to get the co-op into the DMAP program this year.
Uh-huh.
So they will take all of our incisors and age all of the deer for us in the does. And so they gave us some extra doe tags this year to help keep our herd from eating us out of house and home.
Right, right. So what do you think, now that we've, let's say, determined the fact that, you know, habitat manipulation is necessary, it's good, it holds deer close, your success rate has increased. Obviously, you're not the only one to see this, but what do you think is the breaking point for some folks to get on board fully with this, because there's a lot of hesitation to begin cutting trees, right? And dropping that debris on the ground and letting it lay there. And then, not only on top of that, then coming back with prescribed fire and saying, okay, now we're going to burn the timber. You guys are nuts. You're crazy. Let me just leave it as is. Like, what do you think is that biggest hang up? And then what would you say to them from a guy who, you know, you're not, this is a thing of passion for you. I'm air quoting this. You're not formally educated, but you were passionate enough to learn this and apply it because you saw real value there. What would you say to them?
I would say that you got to get over the fear that you're going to destroy your property or hurt your property. And then you have to start on something small to build your confidence.
Uh-huh.
And there is just a lot of, there is so much more information out there, whether it's from consulting or YouTube, or there's a lot of people doing it now, having friends help. But I think getting over that fear that you're going to hurt something. We did not mention that we did a NDA wildlife habitat
module
on my farm this summer that's right. You and Adam hosted.
Yep.
And I remember when we went to one area where I burned some trees where the fire got too hot.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the trees, the canopy, where I didn't do enough TSI, the canopy touch, and it burned a few trees. And I remember some of the people looking mortified, like, well, these trees burned.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's okay. There's right. still thousands of them in there.
Yes. Yes.
But I thought that's how I used to think.
Uh-huh.
That, well,
uh-huh.
what if these big trees catch on fire? Well, some of them are going to catch on fire, and that's okay.
Right.
You're not going to burn the whole neighborhood up if you follow prescribed fire good practices around fire breaks.
Yep.
And burning under the right conditions. And if you have good tools, grip torches and blow torches, and if some people helping you and you're doing it under the right conditions, usually what I find, it's more work to keep the fire going than to keep it from going, getting out of control.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would certainly say that's pretty similar too. I mean, site conditions are obviously, they vary within a burn unit itself. And so some areas go burn better than others. And it's just, you find yourself trying to encourage that fire along more so
right.
than you do, man, can I put it out? Because if you have good fire lines, which is it's just a matter of preparation, then at that point, you know, you're just trying to find that window. And I want
right.
to encourage everyone who is fearful or timid in starting is, yes, be educated. Get educated on it. Take the classes like you've recommended. But at the end of the day, you've just got to either volunteer or just start small. When you do this type of project, start small and build your confidence up from there. Mike, how many times did it take you? So the first time you did the TSI, you realized, wow, I cut, but I didn't cut quite enough. And then, so you learn that, wow, I gotta go more intense. How long did it take you time wise to get confident in acknowledging, okay, this is the level of TSI that I have to go to get that done? Then I'm going to ask you the same question for prescribed fire.
Well, it was for TSI, it was probably about 3 seasons because it mm-hmm. looks so bad that I've never done it before that I thought. And then when we did temporary group openings or bedding thickets,
yep.
I mean, you think, well, that's, it looks like I had a hazardous chemical spill here or something. I mean,
yeah,
it's so seeing the response after three seasons of where I didn't cut enough, I could see the difference between that and where I did these temporary group openings where I cut everything.
Mm-hmm.
And just seeing the response that you get from the seed bank on the plants and the different types of plants that the deer and turkeys like, and bed in and live in. So I'm doing a project this year, which will be a 30-acre project.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get some cost share for it. So this will be my most intense one, and I feel confident. I'm not concerned about it.
Sure.
And a forestry person came out and did a site assessment and put some science around it rather than just me looking at a tree and thinking, okay, can I cut this tree down or not? So that was my, at first, well, do I feel comfortable with this chainsaw? Because I didn't grow up around chainsaws.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
After cutting trees and learning to use wedges and having the proper safety equipment, I just got a lot more confident in felling trees and didn't spend as much time with trying to get trees that I unhung.
Right.
And being able to move through and not spending so much time being frustrated and sweating and scared.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And so same thing with prescribed fire. You know, you took the class, probably did a little volunteer work, or had experienced people the first time you were there, doing prescribed fire on your own. But how many times with prescribed fire did it take you to realize, man, you know, I got this. Like, I got the hang of it. I know how fire is working.
The fire was way easier, even though mentally it may seem like, oh, wow.
It seems really daunting. That's interesting. Yes. I'm glad you kind of pointed that out, because I think that's people would be shocked to hear that.
So I had decent fire breaks, and mm-hmm. that is by far the most work of a prescribed fire.
Yeah.
In my opinion, is getting your fire breaks. So if you have the fire breaks, that just makes it really simple. So mm-hmm. after the first fire that I did, I thought, wow, that was a lot easier than I thought it would be.
Right, right.
And because I just thought when you set the match and all this dead leaf matter and decaying material, it was just going to explode. Well, it doesn't explode.
Yeah, you thought once you had cut that you had created the bomb that you were going to ignite yourself. But in reality, it's not like that. That's not how generally fire responds to debris on the ground and burning up the leaf litter and whatnot. So I'm glad you said that was much easier. So in a season, let's say a prescribed fire season in the spring, did you feel like you gained enough confidence or was it one fire?
It was actually one fire because
nice.
You know, you've got field fires or CRP fires, which are pretty easy. Versus timber is a little more intimidating. But what I found after that first timber fire, I spent more time stripping that fire or keeping that fire going a lot harder. So I thought, wow, this thing it's not as intense as I thought it was going to be.
Certainly. Certainly. Yeah.
And the response was, I mean, in a timber fire, you really see a response pretty quick. I mean, I saw it right in turkey season.
Yeah,
from
right.
Burning in February, and then right in during the turkey season, that soon, just a couple of months later, seeing a response from the wildlife.
Certainly, certainly, and how did the turkeys respond to it too? Because I know we talked a lot about deer, but how did the turkeys respond to it? You said hens were in there a lot, but what about gobbler activity?
Man, if I'm talking the next day, turkeys are in there.
Yeah,
eating roasted bugs, I guess.
Uh-huh, that's right.
And they're in there pecking and eating on it.
Right.
And then that response, they were the next season, they're really nesting in it really thick.
Certainly, yeah.
And it was it made it actually a little easier to hunt, right? Because it's more predictable where they're going to be, which, you know, where the toms are going to set up. They're going to come to where the hens are. And it's kind of a cycle that made the turkey hunting easier, too, so that I wasn't busting turkeys when I'm going in, if they're not gobbling good, or I had a pretty good idea where they were going to be roosted,
right,
based on the habitat manipulation.
So like site selection of hunting and okay, I burned this 2 years ago, so generally birds that are roosted in here are going to be roosted in these locations, and the majority of the birds are going to be here because of the understory that's coming back and developing. Like you can utilize not only the habitat manipulation as a hunting tool or as a land improvement tool, but you're using it as a hunting strategy as well.
Right. And that's how I look at for the deer, mm-hmm. As well as I used to put so much, and I still do a lot of work on food plots, but I thought that was the end all.
That was the ticket.
Right now, the food plot is kind of maybe an attraction point, mm-hmm. but building the habitat around that in my hunting location from a strategic point of view, that makes it, okay, I'm pretty sure based on this wind where these deer are going to come.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't always work that way, but it works that way a lot more than before I did this kind of work.
It was not like you built off beyond, okay, here's a decent location for a food plot. You continued outside of that field edge and edge feathered and then TSI'd and then did the temporary forest openings or bedding cuts beyond that to increase that predictability of deer coming. They're deer bedded there. They're coming through this timber. They might browse a little bit in that TSI, but they're going to pop out into the food plot here because of the edge feathering, and then I've got the final attraction here to kill them and bring them close. It's a step-by-step there.
Right. It is. It's kind of a multi-step different deal, but I mean, and you really notice after hunting season or in the winter, when you walk back in there, you think, oh man, this is where all these beds are at. And, and then it's a lot easier to see the beds and the trails. And you make this little opening on maybe a field edge or through some edge feathering, and you see how it spiders out, and they just, I mean, they're just living there.
Right, right. I mean, there's not much else to say besides the sign tells you exactly what's happening, how they're utilizing it, and you just learn from that and then take that same principle and apply it, which is that principle for everyone listening is cut and burn. Cut at different rates, cut at different degrees based on what you're trying to achieve in an understory and in the future, whether there's timber management involved. But there's nothing that replaces that combination of cut, burn, repeat from a management of the plant communities, management of the natural resources that are available there, but also nothing really competes with that when it comes to the success that you can have year in and year out in an area that I'm going to say is difficult to stand out, but in an area that you have neighbors doing positive things, you're still not this diamond in the rough. That's just this gold star. You're in a good area, but you're successful still in holding, attracting core areas where those deer could have options to go elsewhere. And have quality resources. You're holding them based on not just a food plot, but building off that food plot and cutting and burning and repeating.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that I'm the best in the neighborhood. It's because it would be an insult to my neighbors.
Sure.
But I would say the level that I've been able to complete with the habitat is giving me a higher advantage.
Sure. That's fair.
Because
Absolutely.
There's definitely better hunters than me, but I think I've created a area where maybe they like the house a little better.
I'd rather be a better land manager than the best hunter in a neighborhood. And here's why. Because
yeah.
I know that with quality management, I'm going to have the deer to hunt all season, and if I don't manage the land, if I don't manage the property appropriately, I may be a really skilled hunter, but if I'm hunting a deer that's not on me, that makes it that much more difficult. You may have the best strategy in the world, but when that deer's only on you 25% of the time, it makes it that much more difficult to harvest, no matter your skill set as a hunter. But as a land manager and knowing how to manipulate the landscape to hold those deer, I can afford to not necessarily be the best hunter. I can be a skilled hunter and a skilled woodsman, but it increases my odds that much more. So I think if there's someone out there, you know, I got to learn all this hunting strategy and this and that. Well, sure, that's important. That's important to have a good foundation on. But if you want to be a step ahead, own the deer. And to own the deer, you have to be a good land manager. And so it affords you those opportunities and probability that you're going to be encountering the best deer, the most deer in a given neighborhood.
I had a new guy in the neighborhood just bought joined our co-op.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me, well, how many years did it take you to get to this point? And he says, he's basically, well, when will I be done?
Well, done.
That's not, you won't.
That's because, not a destination.
Right. I said, because he says, well, how long will it take me to get to this point? And I said, uh-huh. Well, you don't stop because every year you've got a different succession.
Right.
If you're doing this right and you're coming back around the circle. So your farm is perpetually in this state of habitat enhancement.
Yeah.
Because if you don't want your whole farm to be in the same growing stage.
That's right.
Because you want different areas to have different responses and a different succession so that it's beneficial to the deer and the turkeys or butterflies or songbirds or whatever you're doing it for, to have different stages. And so you can't look at it and say, well, is this going to take me a year to get it done?
Uh-huh, you know,
I'm going to say no, because if you do it in a year, you're not going to be satisfied with the results in year three, because everything's going to be in the same state of growth. Mm-hmm. You want diversity. And, so you don't have to get it done in a year or two.
That's right. And you're living proof of that diversity is king. It works and it affords you the ability to get into a maintenance type mode and continue to manipulate it, but continue to manage and set back succession. And that proves to be a solid plan for killing and harvesting mature deer and filling turkey tags year in and year out, despite being 10 hours away from home and getting work done. I tip my hat to you, and I know there's a lot of people who certainly will respect you for what it is you've been able to accomplish, learn, and overcome from a guy who didn't grow up in, let's say, this farm background or this wildlife background. It's something that you've just kind of dove head first into and figured it out and figured a way to cover the basis and work with creation opposed against it and learn what it is that really truly makes a difference for the land, for the wildlife. And so, sir, I certainly appreciate it. It's been cool to sit here and watch the past couple of years that success just continue to increase. And I think you said that the buck with the gun was your largest to date. Is that right? Or largest off the farm, at least.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes.
Good, yeah. good. Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I'm guessing it's 6.5. I sent the incisors in today, mm-hmm. but based on pictures and sheds,
right?
You know, he's at least 4.5. I know that. So
sweet.
So I've been blessed. I'm thankful. I get to share these experiences with my kids and my grandkids, mm-hmm. which is far beyond the expectations I ever thought I would have.
Right.
With this piece of land.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it that land can do that. So, sir, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on and sharing your story of success. And, man, this wasn't your first, but it won't be the last time that you're on the podcast either, because I know this is a long road of success for you in the future because of the direction you're heading, and you're going to continue to pursue and make that place that much better. So I can't wait to get back up there next time and spend an evening around a campfire with you.
Hey, same thing. I appreciate what you and Adam are doing. I mean, you're really helping out a lot of people and giving people ideas, and you know, going out of your way to put forth the work you do for giving out content that wasn't around when I started doing this. So appreciate it.
No, thank you, sir. Well, there it is, guys. There is Mike Hinkle himself. What a fantastic stand-up gentleman. But we always love chatting with him because he's just a really real person who just is passionate about his property, passionate about improving it, and has seen that success grow over the years in developing that property into what it is now. And man, it definitely sticks out among not only many northern Missouri properties, but one within a very well-managed cooperative. So he's doing so many good things, and it's just good to see and hear that perspective that he can share outside of what Adam and I may say or Kyle and Frank may say every single week. It is someone else who is here to say, this is what I've done, and here's my success, and it works just like the others have talked about. This is a recipe for success. And so that's lovely to hear. Wonderful. We're happy to share it. So, Mike, thank you for your time. And, guys, thank you for listening. If you haven't been aware, because you may not be subscribed to YouTube, go check out the YouTube channel. There are hunts dropping every single week from this year as well as last year. You got several bow kills, several big buck encounters and buck kills harvest there on the YouTube channel, as well as some management stuff that is coming onto the channel here in the next couple weeks as well. But we're not done with buck harvest, so that's a good thing. So go check that out. Be sure to follow along and answer or ask any questions you guys want there on social media at Land and Legacy. And we appreciate your time tuning in to this week's Land and Legacy podcast. We'll see you here, guys, next week. Yep.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.